troops were assisting UN peacekeepers in repelling an attack by armed groups. Back in October, the regime's military carried out several incursions into the same region in Syria. Over the past month, Israel has stepped up attacks across Syria in violation of the international law and the Arab country's sovereignty. For more on this, we are now joined by Isha Krishnaswamy, podcaster and journalist, joining us from St. Petersburg, Russia. Very good to have you on the program. What's your take on this latest incursion by the Israeli forces?
I think it's been in the plan. Many Israeli government officials always talk about the greater Israel, and I think it is in order to get more territory and solidify their control over Golan Heights. What's curious is how quickly the offense that began in November was able to overrun the Syrian government, which has been able to stay relatively stable for the past 13 or 14 years. So it's very interesting to understand how the rebels were armed this time, who armed them, and how they were able to destabilize the government so quickly in their offense. And I think in the next few days, we'll understand more. But Israel has always been offering aid to the quote-unquote moderate rebels in form of medical aid and also logistic support. So it's no surprise that once the rebels were able to overrun the government, they have allowed Israel to make incursions into Syria.
Now, Isha, this is very significant because it's been like 50 years or more that the Israeli army has entered Syrian territory by tanks and taken territory. Right now that the armed groups are in control, what would be the reaction from them, you think? Or do you think they would be just living with the fact that Israel is going to have its share of their country?
I think so. I mean, the armed groups were able to get control to the support of NATO and the U.S. and a lot through Israel. So I think there was a deal. My personal guess is that there was probably a deal beforehand that if they do get in control, that they do allow Israel to make their incursions into Syrian territory.
But at the same time, we also saw signs of concern from the Israeli side, warning the armed groups not to get close to the Golan Heights.
Well, yes, we did see that, but it is also interesting that Israel actually provided medical aid to many of these armed groups. And if they were seriously concerned about the armed groups incurring into Golan Heights, they would not be supporting them and providing them the aid that they have for the past 10 years.
And what do you think, what is the eventual goal here? Do you think they're trying to kind of remap the entire region?
Absolutely. This has been the plan. General Wesley Clark in 2004 talked about the U.S. plan to destabilize the region, where it began with Iraq, then Libya, then Syria and Iran. And it seems to have followed this plan. And what I worry for Syria is that it's going to turn into another Libya. Libya used to have the highest standard of living in almost all of Africa. And they had prosperity. They had a very high education rate. And after the brutal war and the assassination of Muammar Gaddafi, Libya ended up being destabilized, and basically they were starting to trade slaves in Libya, literally. And so I fear that this is the same thing that's going to happen in Syria too, now that the rebels have taken over. I also worry for the religious minorities in Syria, because in many of the rebel-held areas, religious minorities such as Christians and Druze were severely persecuted.
And at the same time, we know that parts of Syria are still under control by the Kurdish forces that are supported by the U.S. What do you think is going to happen with them? Are they also part of the deal?
Absolutely. A few years back, a general said we have to rebrand them as the SDF, or the Syrian Defense Forces. And a lot of people don't know, but the Kurdish forces have been committing a lot of human rights violations. For example, they draft child soldiers. They've kept many people in inhumane conditions in prisons. And they have also conducted some sort of like ethnic relocation campaign against Assyrians within that area. So yes, they are part of the deal and part of the rebel groups. And they also have been getting support from both US and Israel.
Thank you. Very interesting. You need to get your perspective. That was Isha Krishnaswamy joining us from St. Petersburg, podcaster and journalist. Earlier, we were joined by international lawyer Barry Grossman for his take on the Israeli army's incursion into the Syrian territory under pretext of assisting UN peacekeepers there.
Pretty much anything they say is nonsense. Their claim to legitimacy, of course, was that they were assisting UN peacekeeping troops deal with the threat that they feel was faced from these insurgents. But of course, that's a nonsense, since Israel has always supported them. And quite apart from that, unless you're asleep at the wheel, it's very clear that that's not how the United Nations work. When it has peacekeeping forces in place, it's not permissible for just any country, let alone one that's party to the conflict, to intervene militarily by citing what they claim is a desire to protect UN peacekeeping forces, even as they're bombing UN peacekeeping forces and other organs of the United Nations elsewhere. It's just all utter nonsense. Israel is heavily involved in making excuses. They want to see the Assad government fall. They have had and continue to have aspirations about Syrian territory for a long time, but their primary objective, of course, is to continue to do what they can to create this regional conflagration that will ultimately draw Iran into a conventional war.
Our correspondent Hadi Hotate had traveled to the Bekaa Valley in Lebanon's east, which is the main cross-border road connecting the country to neighboring Syria. He says many Syrians fleeing the conflict in the country have taken refuge in these Lebanon's border area.
We are right now in the Bekaa Valley, directly on the Beirut-Damascus road. This is the main road that connects Lebanon to Syria through the crossing of Al-Masna, a border crossing. This crossing actually witnessed the gathering of thousands of Lebanese and Syrian civilians who were actually seeking shelter inside Lebanon. Those people, of course, were worried that the militants who took over the Damascus, Damascus and the outskirts of Damascus, that they will have acts to retaliate because of the people of Damascus who are known to support the regime, and they did, they do not. I talked to some of them. And of course, they do not believe the promises of the militants and the now so-called opposition that took over Syria. Basically, the HDS, we are talking about the HDS organization or group. The people are seeking shelter here in Lebanon, in Beirut. We can say that the numbers are by maybe more than 100, some thousand, but we are not talking about like more than this, thousand at most. And basically, we can see that there is normal traffic on the road.
More Palestinian civilians are killed as the Israeli military continues to pound the blockaded territory with more attacks. In one of the latest strikes, at least five people were killed after Israeli warplanes bombed tens of displaced Palestinians in Al-Mashala area near Deir al-Bala in central Gaza. Israeli jets also bombed the residential neighborhood in the Gaza city's Shawa neighborhood, killing at least three people and injuring several others. Meanwhile, the Israeli artillery shelled a number of areas across Gaza, leaving an unknown number of people dead and injured. More than 44,600 Palestinians have so far been killed and nearly 106,000 others injured since the regime's onslaught began in October last year. We earlier talked to our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Mosaba to get further details regarding latest Israeli attacks across the besieged Gaza Strip. Let's take a listen.
In the middle area of Gaza Strip, at least five Palestinian civilians were slaughtered after the Israeli fighter drones attacked and hit a makeshift tent in the western part of Deir al-Bala city. Two out of them were children. In addition to that, another residential apartment was hit and targeted by the Israeli warplanes in the western part of Deir al-Balastiri as well. Needless to mention that the eastern part of Al-Maghazi refugee camp actually was hit relentlessly by the Israeli artillery shelling. And even when it comes to the northern part of Nusrat refugee camp, the current situation is still aching, whereas the Israeli occupation forces intensified the artillery shelling against that part. As usual, by the way, even when it comes to Gaza City, the Israeli occupation forces renewed their air base and strikes against multiple neighborhoods, whereas another wave of the destructive and violent Israeli air raids actually hit different parts of a Zaytun neighborhood, targeting several residential buildings there. In addition to that, another house was pounded and destroyed in the vicinity of the Ali Al-Mouk Mosque in a Zaytun neighborhood as well. When it comes to the northern part of Gaza City, as you know, particularly Al-Saftawi area, this area is still witnessing more cruel attacks by the Israeli artillery shelling, in addition to the constant gunfire of the Israeli tanks, as you know, attacking the northern part of Nusrat refugee, the northern part of Gaza Strip, excuse me.
Several Israelis have been wounded during a car ramming operation in the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil. The Israeli forces said one of its soldiers was critically injured in the operation. The attack also wounded three settlers. According to the Israeli media, a Palestinian man carried out the operation as Israeli forces opened fire. The incident has seen the IOF seal off the entrances of the city of Al-Khalil, along with its villages and refugee camps. Palestinians and many observers regard such anti-Israeli operations as a natural reaction to all the crimes being committed against the Palestinian people by the Tel Aviv regime. Israel continues to breach the ceasefire agreement with Lebanon as it has carried out more aerial aggression against the Arab country. In the latest attacks, the regime struck the town of Beit Lif in southern Lebanon, killing five civilians. In a statement, Lebanon's health ministry announced that in a separate incident, an Israeli drone strike also killed one person in Deir Sirian. According to the United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, the number of Israeli violations of the ceasefire has surpassed 155 since November 27th, when the truce between Israel and Lebanon took effect. The aggression against Lebanon since October last year has taken the lives of over 4,000 people. It's been 37 years since the first Palestinian Intifada. Still, the destruction and brutal violence by the Israeli regime is ongoing despite the efforts of the Palestinian resistance to end the occupation. Our correspondent Tiba Asi reports from the city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank.
Palestinian Intifada. As a moment from the past, the Palestinian people are still on the same path as then, fighting their oppressors despite the rise of tensions and the terror produced by the Israeli occupation. Palestinians in the West Bank say, despite the strong, targeted, and calculated effort of this brutal occupation to eliminate the resistance, they stand proud today in order to remember the sacrifices and efforts toward freedom. This is not a conflict. It's called the Israeli occupation of Palestine. They are killing Palestinians every day, evicting them from their own homes, and they are bombing and destroying buildings that means a lot to them. Analysts say this is a calculated effort to eliminate the Palestinian people.
The first Palestinian Intifada, a pivotal moment in Palestine's history, began 37 years ago, and still, after nearly four decades, the resistance movement remains the symbol of Palestinian struggle to end the campaign of destruction and violence by the occupation regime. Tiba Asi, Occupied Palestine.
The spokesman for Iran's foreign ministry says remarks by the IAEA chief concerning Iran's nuclear program are a reaction to an unconstructive and confrontational approach by the West towards Iran. Ismail Baghaei made these comments in reference to Rafael Grossi's statement that Iran is dramatically accelerating its stockpile of enriched uranium with 60% purity. Grossi indicated that this is a clear response to a recent Western-sponsored censure resolution by the IAEA's Board of Governors. Baghaei pointed to Grossi's visit to Iran last month, saying that he had come to Tehran to discuss initiatives to boost Iran-IAEA cooperation. However, the three European countries and the United States pursued a pressure campaign and abused the Board of Governors, which led to the failure of Grossi's efforts. Baghaei stated that the censure resolution was issued without any logical or legal basis. The Iranian spokesman emphasized that Iran's peaceful nuclear program is fully transparent and conducted under the continuous monitoring of the agency. In response to the censure resolution, Iran launched advanced uranium centrifuges among other measures. And that is Zara for this hour's news. Thank you so much. Stay with us for more.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Could you tell a little about yourself?
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of physics. My dad, who taught me the art of life.
Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warmest greetings to you all. Welcome to another edition of Listeners Special Program on this Sunday, December 8, 2024. I'm Atefer Fani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through your emails, your letters, and your messages. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our programs. Tell us which program or programs you like the best. And if you have any message for our listeners around the world, you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. As I always say, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Please keep us company until the end of the program. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special Program, and here we've received reception reports from around the world, including from Lars Jepsen from Sweden. Lars Jepsen has also sent us a piece of email. And also here we've received a piece of email from Foreign Radio Listeners Club from India. Thank you very much for your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. As you may know, these reception reports are very helpful to us, especially to our technicians and engineers, because these reception reports enable us to provide a better service to our listeners around the world. And all of you who have sent in reception reports will be receiving a piece of electronic QSL from IRIB English Radio and Listeners Special Program. Well, after a short break, I will be back with you. Nowhere will you get a better taste of modern Iranian life than in the capital city, Tehran, a city that is sometimes overlooked as a tourist attraction. The primary tourist attractions of this stunning metropolis are its amazing historic museums and residences. But among these wonderful museums, there is one in particular that is concerned with time. the Tehran Time Museum opened its doors not many years ago and is actually the first time museum built in the country. The Time Museum in Tehran is one of the tourist destinations in Iran that goes back to the Qajar era and is more than 80 years old. It is housed in a structure that is still standing in Tehran and has a collection of vintage and antique timepieces and clocks, thus the name Time Museum. That's wonderful. After a short break, I will be back with you. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and here we've received a piece of email from Foreign Radio Listeners Club from India. This club, that is a Radio Listeners Club, says, please send me some IRIB souvenirs and the calendar of 2025, etc. Regards, Foreign Radio Listeners Club from India. First of all, salam and warm greetings to all members of this club, Foreign Radio Listeners Club from India. Thank you very much for writing to Listeners, a special program and IRIB English Radio. A piece of electronic QSL will soon be sent to you as confirmation through this email. Please send our greetings to your club members, Foreign Radio Listeners Club from India. Thank you very much. We are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And your views are always welcome. The history and culture of a nation are preserved in museums. People may visit and examine the objects their ancestors created at museums to obtain a sense of how they lived, celebrated, lamented, entertained, etc. Iranian museums have a wide variety of items from all different historical eras and manufactured by diverse civilizations and languages. Iran is a big nation with a astonishing diversity in terms of the people and ethnicities who have lived there. In addition to several unofficial and personal museums, Iran has 689 officially recognized museums as of 2019. But in this section, we will focus on the Time Museum of Tehran, one of Tehran's most well-known art galleries. The first clock was created by prehistoric humans around 2000 BC, and since then, people have felt the need to measure time. As a result, it is often regarded as one of humankind's first inventions. Nearly every clock made since the beginning has been gathered by Time Museum and shown for the general audience. Such requirements are unique to this museum in Iran. Time Museum's structure dates back to roughly 80 years, but in 1967, Hossein Khodadad, an anesthesian, purchased the museum's structure. He made the decision to convert this structure into a museum since he had a strong passion for art. Since then, there have been several architectural upgrades that have brought this museum to its ideal state. Everybody may visit and take in the progression of time measurements since the beginning of time. Welcome back. Here we have a piece of email from Lars Jepsen from Sweden. Lars says, dear sirs, I had the great pleasure of hearing your station on 918 kilohertz. Details to prove my reception, MP3 recording, personal information, I am 55 years old and I'm working as an environmental inspector. I have been a DXer for 44 years and have so far received verifications from 1840 radio stations in 196 countries. If my recording sounds good, I would be very grateful for your QSL card or verification letter or email. Don't have to be much. Yours sincerely. Salam and warm greetings to you, Lars Jepsen from Sweden. Thank you very much for writing to listeners' special program and IRIB English Radio. Of course, my colleagues will soon send a piece of electronic QSL as confirmation to this email to you. For your information, we would be very glad if you tell us what you think about our programs. Tell us which program or programs you like the best. We wish you all the best and we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon, Lars Jepsen from Sweden. Welcome back. In the heart of a 5-hectare landscape, Time Museum of Tehran edifice rises erect. People may closely examine certain maquettes of the antique clocks in the garden to learn more about how they formerly worked. These clocks include hourglasses, sundial clocks, water clocks, and other similar devices. Since the 17th century, several types of clocks have been on exhibit in the museum, particularly reserved for mechanical, pendulum, torsion, ship's clock, and other types of clocks in the first level. These clocks' outside design demonstrates unequivocally how much attention our predecessors paid to their furnishings. Additionally, a variety of calendars dating back in time have been gathered. Additionally, this museum's second level has watches and pocket clocks. Additionally, a cafe serving delicious snacks and breakfast items is located outdoors in the garden. That's wonderful. And here we come to the end of our today's listeners' special program. Before saying goodbye to you, I just wanted to send my warm appreciations to those of you who have kindly sent us reception reports as well as emails, including Foreign Radio Listeners Club from India and Lars Jepsen from Sweden. Please keep in touch with IRIB English Radio and listeners' special program. We wish you all the best. God bless you. Goodbye.
Dear listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We will be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send us emails to englishradio@irib.ir. Our phone number is 0098-21-2201-3720. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
This one. us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story. In
what is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring
event.
In Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Thanks so much for being with us. The U.S. and some Persian Gulf countries spent billions of dollars trying to overthrow Syrian President Bashar al-Assad by sponsoring and equipping mercenaries from all over the world to create fear and chaos inside of the country. Well, the upheaval began in 2012, and due to the persistence of the Syrian military and the resistance front, Damascus did not fall, but has been continually under pressure since then. And once again, terrorists are on the move in Syria and threatening to destabilize the country and the government. But why now? Stay with us as we take a look at all of this. We'll come back right after this package.
More than a week after the resurgence of terrorist groups in Syria, heavy fighting continues across the country. The Syrian army reports intense clashes with militants on several fronts. Syria had enjoyed relative calm in recent years, but foreign support for terrorist groups and anti-Damascus actions by Western and regional powers have never stopped. Turkey has played a major role in supporting militants opposed to Damascus. Since the beginning of the conflict, Ankara has trained, armed, and provided bases for these groups. In 2016, Turkey launched a direct military intervention in northern Syria, occupying large areas that remain under its control. Recently, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan openly expressed hope for further advances by militants toward Damascus. The United States has significantly contributed to Syria's destabilization. Early in the conflict, the Obama administration covertly supported the so-called Free Syrian Army under the CIA's Timber Sycamore program. While claiming to combat terrorism, Washington's actions weakened Syria's central government, indirectly aiding terrorist groups. U.S. forces have also invaded and occupied eastern Syria, including its oil-rich regions. This occupation has deprived Syria of vital energy resources, compounding its economic crisis. Additionally, the CESAR Act of 2019, signed by Donald Trump, imposed devastating sanctions on Syria, further crippling its economy and worsening civilian suffering. Israel has exacerbated Syria's challenges by repeatedly targeting government-held areas. Damascus has highlighted the clear coordination between Israeli airstrikes and subsequent attacks by terrorist groups. In 2014, Israeli regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu visited a field hospital in the occupied Golan Heights used to treat injured militants, demonstrating direct support for these groups. As the conflict continues, the prospects for peace remain bleak. The U.S., Israel, and some of their allies persist in undermining Syria's sovereignty. However, Iran has actively pushed for diplomatic resolution. On Friday and Saturday, Iran's Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi met with counterparts from Russia, Turkey, Qatar, Iraq, and Syria, emphasizing that only the Syrian people have the right to decide their future, free from foreign interference. Iran continues to stress that diplomacy is the only viable solution to the crisis.
Well, I'd like to welcome my guests to the program, Leila Hatoum, Editor-in-Chief, MENA Uncensored, out of Beirut. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, let's start from here, because it's been just about over a week now that the terrorist group Hayat al-Tahrir al-Sham has suddenly become the top news in the region instead of the genocide in Gaza. I mean, being a journalist, being in this business, tell me your thoughts on that and how these two issues are related, if you think they are.
Well, first of all, good evening, and thank you for having me on your show. And
thank you for coming.
Thank you. And I want to start by painting this picture. Every single thing that happens, not only in the Levant, but the greater Middle East, is all tied together. And it's tied in a game of wars that are started by the U.S. and its allies in the West versus Russia and its allies in the East and some African nations. Every single thing pours into the Mediterranean, not only the Middle East, but the Mediterranean and the Eastern side of the Mediterranean, which is the Levant. What's happening in Syria today not only takes away the light away from the genocide, the ongoing genocide that the Israeli occupation is practicing in Gaza, but also dims any news coming out from the West Bank, where the Israelis are continuing to kill, detain, and torture Palestinians over there and take over their land in the West Bank. Nobody's talking about the West Bank. Also, the Israelis had used the Lebanese front at one point in time to take the news away from what's happening in Gaza. Now the sexy story in international media, and it's on purpose being covered in international media as such, is Syria. Syria is critical at the same time, because if Syria falls, that means Lebanon is next. And if those two fronts fall, then there will be no real support at close proximity to the Palestinians. And that would mean Palestine will cease to exist, because the Israelis will find it easier for them to take over, and nobody from closer borders would be able to help out. So Syria is critical for regional countries. It's also critical basically for Palestine, and it's being used to dim the light and basically create what you call media blackout when it comes to Gaza and the West Bank.
All right. Well, I'd like to welcome our next guest to the program, Sakina Datto, journalist and producer out of London. Thanks so much for joining us, Sakina. Your thoughts, why now? Why are we seeing the rise of this terrorist group, or I won't say again since it's changed its name, but the rise of this terrorism once again at this time in Syria?
I think this is all pre-planned. This isn't something that has just happened suddenly. The people, I think all of us, were caught a little bit by surprise, but in reality, they have been preparing for this. And this is precisely why we saw a ceasefire happening in Lebanon. Because if you look at the Zionist entity of Israel, they miscalculated when they started their war with Lebanon and thought that they'd very easily be able to overpower and overcome Hezbollah, which didn't happen. And in the last days, the huge beatings that they were getting from the resistance groups made them rethink that strategy. So the strategy was to kind of off balance, the whole idea of a ceasefire, thinking that they were retreating. But in reality, they were planning this all along with Turkey. Of course, there is the hand of the US, the NATO countries. These are all behind what we see in Syria. So the most amazing thing is that these same ISIS, in their black clothes that were so despised here in the West, have just had a change of tone and a change of clothes, and suddenly they are palatable to the Western audiences. But this is nothing new. If you look at the whole idea of how the West has been playing the cards in the Middle East, it's always coming up with a sectarian card. Whenever they do not, see any other way of winning the war, they try and create a sectarian war. Now, we know that what's happening in Syria has got nothing to do with Sunni and Shia, but that is what they are trying to promote. And the unity that we saw of Muslims coming together at the time of, fighting this genocide in Palestine, very sadly, I don't know whether it will hold or not, because there is a lot of psychological warfare in the media trying to make this look like this is a Sunni-Shia divide.
Interesting points. What about that, Leila? Your thoughts? Sakina said, the solidarity, the global solidarity we've seen across the board in supporting the Palestinian cause, how has that been affected with this current crisis in Syria? And why would it be affected, especially if we're talking about people of the region who understand what is happening with the Palestinian issue? But how could they separate that from what's happening in Syria, your perspective?
Well, I have to be very frank when it comes to this matter. People across the world are prone to following sexy news. That's the first thing. And the second thing is that international media dictates what you get to see in the media, including social media platforms that are not as innocent as you think they are. They're curbing the voices of those who support Palestine in favor of news that is coming out from Syria or elsewhere across the world. And when this happens, basically, the supporters of Palestine get divided. Some of them want to know what's happening in Syria because it's all over, and others basically try to figure out why it is important for Palestine to follow up on the Syrian news. and they get a lot of basically misconception and propaganda that's on purpose being distributed by the traditional media outlets that are controlled by America and its allies, along with the Muslim Brotherhood groups that are basically in favor of Erdogan, and Erdogan supports them, as well as Qatar supports them. At the end of the day, as Sakina said, and as you had said in previous shows as well, billions of dollars, not billions, hundreds of billions of dollars have been poured in to create this kind of propaganda since 2011 until today. And it's happening now for a reason. As Sakina, Ms. Sakina said, the Lebanese front proved to be really hard for the Israelis. It is in favor of Hezbollah to actually have a ceasefire along the southern front so they can actually secure the northern Lebanese front and the eastern Lebanese front, which is basically the borders with Syria, because at any point Syria falls, we will have another wave of suicide bombers that come to Lebanon, and basically they're going to kill our people. This happened between 2011 and 2013. Hezbollah intervened in the Syrian war in May 2013, 2 years and a half after it started. And that's how we managed to curb the waves of suicide bombers from there. At the same time, the Israelis found it really hard for them to take over Lebanon alone. So they moved the Syrian front to weaken Hezbollah internally. At the end of the day, a ceasefire does not serve the Israelis much as basically you move the Syrian front and you have Hezbollah engaged over there again. And we heard it. At the end of the day, you also have the SDF of or Syrian Democratic Forces that are found in East Syria. They said yesterday that they knew about this attack being brewed for the past few weeks. So everybody was prepared. They were just waiting for the green light for it to happen. The Israelis were planning it and the Americans were planning it.
Well, Sakina, the foreign ministers of Iran, Russia, and Turkey met in Doha within the framework of negotiations known as the Astana peace process. So your opinion about these talks?
We haven't heard much about what has been the outcome of it. But for me personally, I think, you know, at this stage, as we see this army advancing now towards the homes, I think this is, I'm a bit skeptical about the whole idea of a peace negotiation at this stage. I think it's critical that right now Iran and Russia really actually intervene in Syria directly. Because if these forces are now from Hama, if they manage to get to homes, then, Damascus is going to fall. And that is 90% certain that if they take homes, then they are going to, Damascus is going to fall. And like Sister said, I think, this is critical. If Syria falls, then Lebanon is in a really dangerous situation. Of course, all their efforts are towards Iran next. So I think if there was ever a time, this is not a time, in my view, for peace talks. It's a time, I think, for the Russians and the Iranians to really act right now and ensure that, whether it takes air bombing or whatever it is, to ensure that, they get rid of these ISIS, these terrorists. It is very upsetting, in a way, to say that how is it possible that for the past 1 year, everybody has stood with the Muslims around the world, have stood with the idea of a free Palestine together. And it is so obvious with the statements that are being made by Turkey, the statements that are coming out from Israel, and this group also saying that they would like to establish relations. If they were able to capture Syria, they will establish relations with Israel. Now, it really is a question of the propaganda that is going on in the media. In Syria right now, people who are being interviewed there are saying, when they open their Facebook, for example, there is a bombardment from a certain group of the media. Qatar is also there. And so we see their network very heavily spreading propaganda, a network that was up to now, supporting the cause of Palestine. Starlink, for example, this is something that the Americans are facilitating, whereas most people don't have an internet. You find that these rebel groups have got very strong internet. So there is a major war happening in the media. And what it is doing is that it's creating panic inside. So we continuously have been hearing about the fact that Bashar Assad has run away, that there is incursions. These are not always true. So I think the media warfare is the one to really watch right now. And we need people from all around the world, these alternative medias that are also social media that are coming along. We have, if ever sure there was a job to do. This is the time to do it. There is such a lot of misinformation that even people who think they are aware of what is happening are constantly getting confused about all the different factors. So really, we are in very dangerous times.
Yes, indeed. Well, Leila, your perspective, Sakina had mentioned about Turkey. Let's look a little bit deeper into the role of Turkey in all of this. What does Erdogan want in your perspective? I mean, and why now? Why now in the middle? Once again, I'll go back to the genocide, because on the one hand, we know Erdogan, well, he sometimes talks a good talk about supporting the Palestinians, although the reality is something else. So your perspective, the role that Turkey is playing in all of this.
Was, is, and will continue to play, if you allow me to say that, if you may allow me to say that. Mm-hmm. Erdogan, since day one, has always sold people words. He's good with words, but he's a man of no action. He doesn't walk the talk, much like Benjamin Netanyahu. He is called King Bibi for a reason. He can sell dreams to people at one point, but he doesn't actually fulfill everything. Erdogan had vowed to cut ties or sever ties with the Israeli entity since May 2024. Since then until now, he continues to send energy, oil tankers to the Israeli entity. Most of those are tankers that belong or are operated by his son Bilal. And he continues to send perishables, among other things, to the Israeli entity. In fact, the Israeli ambassador to Turkey is still there. They didn't sever their ties with the Israeli entity. The Turks didn't sever, have not severed their ties with the Israeli entity. He has been doing it forever. He goes out and he cries over Palestine so he can actually sell some sentiments to the Islamic world and the Arab world. But in reality, over the table, he's still basically shaking hands with the Israelis. He did that back in 2011 and in 2012 and 2013. I remember I witnessed one of his antiques a week before he actually joined one of the forums in Sharjah back around 10 years ago. And I was attending that forum. He had signed a military agreement with the Israelis. And later on, a week or so later on, he actually came over to Sharjah and he cried over Palestine, which was very interesting to watch. And then by then we understood that the game very well. He's supported by the Muslim Brotherhood and he supports them. And his propaganda actually helps create or insinuate that everything is under control. But what Turkey really wants is to secure its borders with Syria. Remember, northern Syria, northeastern Syria is PKK land at the moment. They are being supported by the Americans. The Kurds pose a threat to the Kurds, to the Turkish country. And at the same time, the Turkish people want to have Muslim Brotherhood in power in Syria. That's why they have military bases deep inside the Syrian territories. We're not only talking about the border lines, Tel Rifat or Azaz or others. No, we're talking about Idlib. They have military bases in Idlib, but not posts, military bases. And the Turks will not withdraw from there. They want to create a buffer zone, much like the Israelis are creating a buffer zone, basically with Lebanon and with Syria at one point.
Well, Sakina, I mean, Turkey has been occupying parts of Syria since 2016, as well as the U.S., which has occupied the oil-rich parts of Syria and still stealing its resource. Let's talk about how this has affected the overall economic situation, the security situation in Syria all these years.
So along with all those occupations, and also if you look at the sanctions and the effect that has had on the economic, ability of Syria. Syria was weakened at the moment when you're asking why now. It's because at the moment Syria was in a weak position, not just Syria, but I think, you know, the area that generally after this war, the genocide that has been going on, Lebanon, obviously, the last war we saw in Syria and the incursion of the ISIS, Hezbollah played a big part pushing them back. But at the moment, with the war that has just ended and there is a rebuilding happening, this was the most sensitive time. That is on one side. On the other side, you know, Bashar al-Assad was in the process of changing the army system. So whereas, you know, we know that there were Iranian military people, for example, in Aleppo, they were sent back and he was trying to get this newer crop of young people who are really not yet, solid enough to be able to fight with with those who have been given all sorts of support by trained by NATO, given the best of ammunitions. So in a way, this was a weak point at which they could do this. That is one. But also, I mean, Turkey, I think Erdogan has always had the ambitions of the, you know, the Ottoman-style ambitions of trying to expand and become a sort of a sultan. The other thing that ties in with this is the U.S. Now, in the U.S., the Democrats, you know that when Trump comes in, Trump has, although he is not a great guy, and we know that, but I think Trump has been talking a language of, for example, wanting to withdraw his troops from Syria. Now, in that context, they know the deep state are the Democrats, and they know that when Trump comes in, the situation may change. So they wanted to make sure before he comes in January, they just go in there and do whatever they need to do to secure, you know, Syria and the support of Turkey. At the same time, Israel also wanting, you know, part of Syria. So I think all these things have aligned together at a time when the resistance in all parts have been a little bit weakened by the supporting, you know, being against the genocide and supporting Palestinians.
And final question, Leila, where do you see this going? What needs to happen to change what we're looking at, the rapid aggression by the terrorists that we're watching now in Syria? In your perspective, what has to happen?
I'm not sure if everybody has followed the Doha meetings closely, where they presented a draft for a roadmap in order to solve the situation in Syria. I don't see any solution in the coming year, at least, a real solution at least. And that's because Syria has been severely divided sectarian-wise and when you call it basically also groups-wise, political-wise, even what you call the former opposition and the terrorists and the radicals, each one is trying to create a power grab before Trump comes into power. So nothing will be on the table and discussed thoroughly until Trump takes over. The Kurds are waiting for Trump to come over so he can give them a piece of Syria and Iraq and Turkey. The Israelis are waiting for Trump to come over so he can actually give them a green light or support what they are planning to do. When it comes to the Americans, Trump is not going to change the foreign policy. The U.S. foreign policy doesn't change. You change the presidents, but the foreign policy remains the same. The execution is what differs. I don't believe that Trump is going to pull out the troops. Remember, when he came into power in 2016, he had promised to pull out troops from Iraq and elsewhere. They continue to have one of the largest bases in the region, in Iraq, Ayn al-Assad, as well as basically creating more. We have dozens of U.S. Bases in Syria, including in Atanf and Conoco. And at the same time, Trump just talks about it. Who bombarded Syria over the past few years during Trump's tenure? The Americans. So if you look at it, I don't see a solution. What needs to be done, I do believe, is basically for the Turks and the Qataris and the Americans and the Israelis to take off their hands and let the Syrians solve it among each other. Remember, President Bashar al-Assad had, since day one in Syria, since 14 years ago, called for what you call, or 13 years ago, called for political solution and discussions so they can reach a solution on the table. Only the Syrians would be able to change the situation on the ground so long that these powers that we just named take off their hands of Syria. I highly doubt it's going to happen. I'm being very realistic. For the next year, we're going to see the situation deteriorate unless in the next coming few hours, Russia manages with Iran to turn the tables. We know. We have heard information while I was coming down from South Lebanon to Beirut shortly before this show started that the Russians and the Syrian Air Force managed to hammer the terrorists who were approaching to Hamas, and they turned the tables also around Hamas and
15 seconds.
Closer to Aleppo. Yeah, thank you.
All right, well, thank you both for being with me, Leila Hatoum, editor-in-chief, Mini Uncensored out of Beirut, Sakina Datto, journalist and producer out of London. And thank you for being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye.
is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is iranradio.ir. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
We once had a teacher, the teacher of teachers. He changed the world for the better and made us better creatures.
In the name of Allah, Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome to the program, The Teacher. Please stay with us.
What will we say in front of it?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum and we're welcome to another episode of the program The Teacher, an introduction and analysis on the most important Islamic teachings and concepts. I'm Atal, the host of this program. Within the studio, I have two special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom, Sheikh Rouhani and Brother Alevian. Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Brother Alevian, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Alright, for today's episode of the program The Teacher, we want to talk about another Islamic concept, which is khulud. Sheikh Rouhani, let's start with giving us a definition of what khulud is exactly.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Khulud means a kind of eternal, being or life in the... Particularly, it is mostly used in the Quran for Jahannam, but of course... Khulud in Jannah is also true. In here, afterlife, we have two kind of lives. Life in Jahannam or the hell in the hellfire and also the Jannah or paradise. The point is that, is it possible for some people to remain in Jahannam forever, eternally?
Okay.
So this kind of eternity in Jahannam is called Khulud.
Is it only referring to being in hellfire or no? It could be, for example, being eternal in the heaven too.
Of course, and when you you first go to Jahannam and then you go to Jannah, if, for example, you are the people of both Jannah and Jahannam.
Okay.
It's not like this, that you first go to Jannah and then go to Jahannam.
Mm.
So that's why khulud particularly means with Jahannam, that whether, because in Jannah, whenever some person enters to Jannah, he will be there forever.
All right.
But what is important is the eternal chastisement or punishment. This is called khulud. That is why there are different views in this respect. That, of course, khulud is there. There are some people who will remain in Jahannam forever. But mm-hmm. which kind of people they are among the Mufassirin or yes. the interpreters and exegetes of the Holy Quran, there are different views. Some of them says that only kuffar,
okay.
the disbelievers, will remain there for